This is the Doctor, President-elect of the High Council of Time Lords, keeper of the legacy of Rassilon, defender of the laws of time, protector of Gallifrey.
I will not forget your line of this. Not one day.
Like many scientists, I'm afraid the Rani simply sees us as walking heaps of chemicals. There's no place for the soul in her scheme of things.
You are absolute idiots!
We are not idiots! We want to go home!
Yes, home!
I am Dr. Idiot.
Smith. Dr. John Smith.
Get off my world.
They're human beings, if that's what you mean, indulging their favorite pastime, trying to destroy each other.
Cancel the detonation.
Countermand it.
Cancel the detonation.
Countermand it.
I'm going to kill you in a minute.
Don't blink. Don't even blink. Blink and you're dead.
I say, what a wonderful butler. He's so violent.
Absolutely exquisite.
This is the 37th installment of the Who's On podcast. You can find us on iTunes, Player FM, our own website, whosonpodcast.com, and Facebook. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm joined by Rob.
And a ringing phone.
My phone. And Peter.
Hello.
Today we'll be discussing the Zygon invasion and the Zygon inversion, written by Peter Harness. Well, at least the invasion is. Did he write both? I'm not exactly sure.
You know what? I think he wrote the first by himself, and I believe the second one listed him and Stephen Moffat.
Yeah, Moffat was on the second one as well.
So this episode, that's two episodes, stirred up a lot of controversy on the internet. Oh, let's want to play the speech, because it's the most important speech that we've heard in Doctor Who for a long, long time. I guess since Matt Smith's speech to the pumpkin god.
Yeah.
What is it that you actually want?
War.
Right. And when this war is over, when you have a homeland free from humans, what do you think it's going to be like? Do you know? Have you thought about it? Have you given it any consideration? Because you're very close to getting what you want. What's it going to be like? Paint me a picture. Are you going to live in houses? Do you want people to go to work? Will there be holidays? Oh, will there be music? Do you think people will be allowed to play violins? Who's going to make the violins? Well, you don't actually know, do you? Because, like every other tantruming child in history, Bonnie, you don't actually know what you want. So let me ask you a question about this brave new world of yours. When you've killed all the bad guys, and when it's all perfect and just and fair, when you have finally got it exactly the way you want it, what are you going to do with the people like you? The troublemakers. How are you going to protect your glorious revolution from the next one?
We'll win.
Oh, will you? Well, maybe. Maybe you will win. But nobody wins for long. The wheel just keeps turning. So come on. Break the cycle.
Why are you still talking?
Because I want to get you to see, and I'm almost there.
Do you know what I see, Doctor? A box. A box with everything I need. A 50% chance.
For us too.
And we're off! Fingers on buzzers! Are you feeling lucky? Are you ready to play the game? Who's going to be quickest? Who's going to be luckiest?
This is not a game!
No, it's not a game, sweetheart, and I mean that most sincerely.
Why are you doing this?
Yes, I'd quite like to know that, too. You set this up. Why?
Because it's not a game, Kate. This is a scale model of war. Every war ever fought right there in front of you. Because it's always the same. When you fire that first shot, no matter how right you feel, you have no idea who's going to die. You don't know whose children are going to scream and burn. How many hearts will be broken? How many lives shattered? How much blood will spill until everybody does what they're always going to have to do from the very beginning? Sit down and talk! Listen to me, listen. I just want you to think. Do you know what thinking is? It's just a fancy word for changing your mind.
I will not change my mind.
Then you will die stupid. Alternatively, you could step away from that box. You could walk right out of that door and you could stand your revolution down.
No. I'm not stopping this, Doctor. I started it. I will not stop it. You think they'll let me go after what I've done?
You're all the same, you screaming kids. You know that? Look at me. I'm unforgivable. Well, here's the unforeseeable. I forgive you after all you've done. I forgive you.
You don't understand. You will never understand.
I don't understand. Are you kidding? Me? Of course I understand. I mean, do you call this a war, this funny little thing? This is not a war. I fought in a bigger war than you will ever know. I did worse things than you could ever imagine. And when I close my eyes, I hear more screams than anyone could ever be able to count. And you know what you do with all that pain? Shall I tell you where you put it? You hold it tight. Burns your hand, and you say this: no one else will ever have to live like this. No one else will ever have to feel this pain. Not on my watch.
Lots to react to.
Yeah.
Sorry for the long clip, but I think it was important. Starting the podcast off with the most important part of the episode. Peter, instant reaction.
This particular episode was a very timely episode in world events, I would think. It was just 8 days ago when we had the attack on Paris. And it's interesting to compare and contrast what Paris and France has decided to do compared to what America did when we were bombed by the planes in 9/11. And it creates a painful comparison between a nation that has said, you know what, we're going to take in another 30,000 refugees over the next 2 years. And there's the one YouTube clip of the one husband whose wife was killed at the nightclub concert, who talks about, I'm not going to let the terrorists win in making me respond poorly to their actions. That element of forgiveness. And the doctor had that great line when the commander says, I'm unforgivable. And he's like, no, I forgive you. Forgiveness can be a very powerful thing, and it's the first step in a necessary change in a person. You know, when we are in a moment of despair, there is no hope. And really, that's, I think, another element of what this season is kind of doing. What are the consequences of our mindset? Have we hope, or are we in despair? The commander was in despair and saw no other way out. The doctor, however, the whole reason why he did this whole long speech, and when he's asked, why are you doing this? In one short word, it would be hope. He has hope. Hope that they will sit down and talk. And I think part of the episode was, this has happened before, where people were getting frustrated and wanting to hit the button, and he's talked them through. Kate's mind has been wiped before.
15 times.
Yep.
Which seemed a little crazy to me.
But at the same time, there is an element of maybe they don't need to wipe her memory as much as they have been. Other than the whole concept of the box becomes void. Because it's really just a MacGuffin to get people to get into the same room together.
Did you know it was empty? Did you know it was empty, I should say?
I suspected it was, because that would be so unlike the doctor to have had it in there. Although, the doctor lies. So, you know, he may have had something in there, but it may have also been just a jack-in-the-box springing out going, nope.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, for me, this was a very, very timely and powerful episode. And listening to the Doctor's speech about 2 hours before I watched the episode, I had gotten a phone call from my friend Dan in Israel. And for about a year and a half now, we had been trying to find out what had happened to a friend of us in Syria, in the town of Sarmada. And Dan told me that our friend Samir and his family had been killed by the ISIS terrorists sometime within the last year. He didn't even know. And I'm still working out a lot of my emotions in that, in the grieving process. But the Doctor's speech reminds me again, I have a choice between despair and hope for myself. To respond to the death of my friend in either a positive or a negative way. I could either get a gun and go out and start killing people over in Syria who murdered my friend, or I can try and do something that will change the cycle that is causing this. I'd rather do the change.
Your instant reaction, Rob?
While I was watching the episode, I was waiting. I had seen most of the speech clip before I watched the episode. I kind of spoiled it for myself a little bit, I think. But when it actually got to that point and I was watching it, all I could do was sit there and just think, thank you. Mm-hmm. For whoever was responsible for, you know, the script or whatever, however much, you know, that Peter Capaldi put into delivering it as the character. Because when he gets loud and says, you know, just sit down and talk, and he just, like, loses it, I thought I was looking in the mirror to some degree.
Mm.
Because that's just, over the last few years, with the way that my mindset has changed about, you know, violence and all that stuff, it just felt like he was just saying all the things that I've been trying to say. So to see it being said on a television show that more than five people watch was just very comforting, if you will.
I have a number of different reactions in my own head. I loved the speech. I am anti-war as well. At the same time, I think there was trying to draw parallels to Islamic extremists in this episode, using the Zygons sort of as the foil for that.
Yep.
And I don't see the comparison. So I'm a little bit in a different place. Now, if we were talking about a country versus country, then I can see that more.
I think they needed to make, in order to have this be a comparison to the extremist and the terrorism that's going on, they couldn't have it as country to country. It had to be the person who might be your neighbor. And that touches in a lot of what science fiction has done. Who do you trust? Why do you trust them? Can you trust your neighbor? And that goes back to me, for me at least, to Jesus when he was asked, well, who is my neighbor? And he tells us this really awesome story about the rich religious leader and the rich legal leader who just walk on by, the people you expect to be helping, and then the scum of society being the one who is the hero of that story. He was the one who was being the neighbor. Not because they were locals to one another, but because his love transcended social and cultural boundaries. So it had
But what do the Islamic extremists really want? He asked Bonnie, what do you actually want? You know, who's going to make the violins? Yeah. Are you going to have music? Are you going to have jobs? I mean, is it what the extremists want? Is it Sharia law? Is it their own way and annihilation of everyone else who doesn't think the same? There's those number of questions that sitting down and talking, sometimes there are no compromise.
Yes and no. Cracked.com, of all sites, actually posted one of the most insightful articles that I've read about ISIS ever. And my friend had linked it to my Facebook page, and I read it really early this morning. And it really gutturally hit me how as much as I hate ISIS or Daesh, whatever we want to call them, they have a lot of the same goals and desires as everybody else. They have this really fancy, glossy magazine that they publish that tells you exactly what their goals are. And it's not just destruction. They really do want to create what they feel is an ideal society.
Mm-hmm. See, I don't believe half of it, though, because what we see is green screen put up to make them look like giants. We see them with British accents. We see them, mm-hmm. and to me, as someone who's watched since 9/11 here in the United States, I don't know what to believe anymore.
Yeah, well,
and that's what it comes down to for me.
Some of your fear, though, I think is stemming out of what is our media producing versus what are they, the terrorists, requesting. They want to create hospitals. They want to create a new society, granted within their extremism.
But are we funding them? And how many, as Putin said, the G20 conference was right there. Is this a staged event again? Is this another false flag? Yep. I mean, how many of these are we going to have to take? Is ISIS our creation?
Yes,
I would say yes. And through this episode, and not creation because we drone attack Yemen and all these other countries that we shouldn't be involved in, as a pacifist, as someone who doesn't want war and who wants globalism in the way to benefit others. And capitalism makes friends of people who are born enemies when it comes to religion. If you can provide me with this thing, I can provide you with this thing.
Yeah.
Rather than having any middleman, rather than disputing over this minutiae of religious points or dogma or whatever, when people, all they want is their families to be safe and secure, I would hope, from the other side as well.
See, Rob? for that point, though, I see that the episode isn't just trying to make a point about Islamic extremists. I even see that the Zygons could just as easily be violent anarchists. Because if that's the same thing, right? They want to be able to be who they are. They want to be free to live the way that they want to live without anybody telling them how to do so. A lot of the time, you see them trying to throw Molotov cocktails and flip police cars and throw stones at courthouses. That's how that's how most operate. I don't think they're trying to limit it to one specific kind of extremist. I think that it's left open enough
but
to be
any group.
Yeah.
They do kind of though do that with the one man who is being forced to show his real face.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like outing him when he didn't want to be outed.
Yes.
Right.
And it's the way a lot of people lump all Muslims together. And we live in New Jersey. We live around Muslims all the time, and there's no problem. There's never any problem. We all understand each other. We all have discussions, and we have mosques. I have a mosque right across the street.
Literally.
I mean, yes, literally. And there isn't that thing going on that seems to be going on around the world. I don't know who's...
Well, because we're here. We're not somewhere else.
Yeah.
You know, we're not in Iraq and Syria where we see Christian America sending soldiers over there to dictate who's going to be in charge. I mean, look what we did with Syria. We threw out the last leader to replace him. Iraq. Yes, I'm sorry. But it's also not the first time.
Don't get ahead of yourself.
It's also not the first time we've done that either, though, where we've said, well, we want to institute democracy, so we're going to come over here. We're going to send soldiers to go and get rid of the ruler that we don't like, and we're going to institute our way of life
on a
completely separate group of people that have no idea how we work.
If democracy works, democracy will be instituted by those people who are in power. If communism doesn't work and it fails because it doesn't work, because it'll rot from the inside. Democracy, we're not a democracy in the United States.
No.
Contrary to what the world may believe, we're supposed to be a representative republic.
Yeah.
Yes.
Unfortunately, many of our leaders don't actually represent many of the constituents.
Well, I believe that's partly because people don't take advantage of the opportunities they have.
I agree.
Yeah.
It becomes almost like big business. It becomes big pharma. All this big stuff. And so you have the people with all the money who are controlling the rest. And there's not enough personal involvement on a local level. It starts on a local level and then moves on. And that's the way a representative republic is supposed to work. So that I can call up my representative and say, Noah, I don't really agree with how you voted here. And with technology through Facebook and emailing, that should be very simple now. Whereas you used to be able to have to just call or write a letter, an actual letter, folks.
Yeah.
And on that note, politicians today respond more favorably and pay more attention to a handwritten note than they do an email or any kind of type information. Right.
Well, because how often do they have just a form letter that you can just click send and you, like, fill in your name? You fill in your name and there it goes.
Yeah. But that, it's anyone on Capitol Hill or any politician, there's just that psychological thing of, wow, this person took the time to handwrite something. Mm-hmm. And it automatically makes them pay more attention. But
yeah. In the matter of forgiveness.
Yes.
He said he forgives Bonnie. Now, I think Jenna Coleman did such a great job as Bonnie.
As soon as she
tied her hair back, you knew she was Bonnie. You knew she was different.
Yep.
And then playing along within the first and second episodes of this, the end of the first episode. And I liked how they showed the reveal of when it actually happened that she became Bonnie.
Which was neat when they showed it. If you pay enough attention to that first scene where Jenna's in the apartment, like trying to see what's going on, there's a mirror facing her. So there's already a second her, if you will, in the room. Like, I just thought it was really neat because it was just a way of kind of, like you said, introducing the change without, like, being blatant about it at the time.
So the doctor is offering his forgiveness because he is president of the world in this, I guess. Mm-hmm. The previous to this, it was said that he's 2,000 years old. I could be your messiah, you know, in a way.
Yeah, I heard that.
So the religious leaders of the time during Christ had a real issue with Christ forgiving someone. Who are you to forgive someone?
Yeah. Yep.
Especially because it was forgiveness of sin. And interestingly enough, the only time that Jesus makes a point of saying, I forgive you, is in front of the religious leaders. When they are not there, sin's not even brought in. The person who is feeling the conviction, he needs not make any mention of their sin.
Mm-hmm.
With Zacchaeus, he didn't say anything about sin. Zacchaeus was already saying, I'm going to do this. The woman washing his feet, no mention of her sins. The guy who's blind, Peter makes the point of, whose sin is this? And then Jesus makes the point, it's nobody's sin.
Right, because they thought it was a generational sin, where sins of the father visit the sins of the son.
I think the only time that I might quibble, if you will, we'll use that word.
Sure.
The only time I might quibble with that a little bit is the rich young ruler.
Yeah.
Where when he asked, you know, what do I need to do? And Jesus, without saying, your sin is this, you know, he just kind of... But again, he already was struggling with the issue of money, I believe. And that's why Jesus, all he had to say was, sell all your things.
And that's why the guy hung his head in shame, because he's like, I can't do that.
But it was already a struggle. It wasn't, it wasn't Jesus coming in and pointing
out.
We
could get into a whole other thing about that.
Yeah, we'll
leave it. We'll stick to Doctor Who.
Yeah.
I like the little girls. As the main two Zygons, I thought that was very remembrance of the Daleks, because you had the little girl who was controlling the renegade Daleks.
I expected that he was going to be wrong. I expected it was going to be one of those things where he's like talking to
just
these little girls.
Just a creepy old man?
Like, yeah, exactly. That's what I thought was
going
to happen.
I was going there too. It was neat that they had two commanders. I thought that was a very well done foreshadowing of what they were talking about. There's always two. There were two Osgoods at the beginning, and then the one kind of goes a little mad when the mistress kills the other, you know, whether it was the human or the Zygon. And that was also kind of neat that they're looking at people as true potential, not predetermined. So there's no Calvinism in this episode. It's very much an Arminian episode, which makes me happy. And it's running with this idea of, you have so much potential that you don't even know to tap yet. And it's done by the two girls, the two Osgoods, two of everything, this yes and no, yin and yang kind of option.
Why do you think he was so concerned of which one was which? He kept asking, which one are you, the human or the Zygon? And she kept deferring.
I think he's worried about the hybrid thing again. Because he hints at it once or twice.
It is a common theme through this season, hybridization.
But true.
Plus, the human Osgood would be the original. And I think maybe there was some level of wanting to be able to appeal to her Earthling humanity, as opposed to appealing to...
But the Doctor doesn't make any distinction between Zygon and human. It happens in Pertwee episodes all the time where there isn't that favoritism. Oh, you're an alien race. He's an alien. He's from Gallifrey. So you're an alien. He is on Earth a lot of times, but
it reminds
and he has human companions many times.
It reminds me back to the episode where they had the miners who had the plastic people under Matt Smith. And it was all about the shoes. What type of shoe was he wearing? And that was either the real Doctor or the copy.
Yeah, one of the few double episodes from Matt Smith's era.
And again, the Doctor was perfectly fine with having a copy because it wasn't whether or not you were the real thing or the copy. You still had the same potentials. And I think that's kind of what they were going for with here. For me, it wasn't so much the Doctor within that universe being worried. It was more, I think, the writer trying to not necessarily bludgeon the point, but keep on bringing back into your face of it doesn't matter what you are, it matters what you become.
Right.
Truth or consequences. There's three different times. The truth or consequences in New Mexico that Clara knows because she's a Trivial Pursuit person, she says. Somehow. I didn't see that coming beforehand.
And having been a huge Trivial Pursuit person, I don't actually remember that as a question.
And also, it used to be an American game show.
Yes.
I watched Truth or Consequences last night, and they gave every contestant on there a carton of cigarettes.
Oh.
Old Glory, something like that. Mm. It was a very looking back at it now, it would have never aired the episode that I watched. But anyway, it was that's why he has that American game show accent.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, hands on the buzzers.
Yep.
Yeah.
Because he's trying to convey that hey, this is Truth or Consequences too. And I love how it was just like little tape that said Truth or Consequences. It wasn't.
Yeah,
high production. It was like one of those little tape gun machines that you dispense the word.
It's those automatic labelers that you can buy at Staples for 99 cents.
Exactly.
So. Yeah.
And so why the red and the blue?
Any primary reason? Colors, red and blue. You have red for blood, blue for peace, psychology of colors.
Did the blue represent the TARDIS in any way?
It could have.
Maybe as the aliens.
TARDIS, we've heard many times that the sound brings hope, but I think the color does, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting.
Yeah. One point that I want to touch on before we move on to the next element, going back to the Doctor's speech, he asks Bonnie, what is it that you want? She answers with war, and then he starts talking about, well, what happens when you've done everything, what happens to the people who are like you? And that reminded me of really great movie, Serenity, which I actually happen to be wearing one of my Serenity t-shirts.
It reminded me of Cuba.
Oh, interesting.
Castro.
Yeah. But for me, the reason why it reminded me of Serenity, the agent that is chasing the crew of the Serenity, when he's asked, what... his role will be in this brave new world that he wants to create. And he's basically, with one answer, I want to create a world in which I cannot exist. And I always thought that was a very impactful thing. Somebody who has such hope, but realizes that they are the monster that they need to cut out of this world that they want to create.
Mm-hmm.
He had a much deeper understanding of what I do is evil without any pretense that it's good, he's looking more for the greater good, and so does great evil to bring about a place where he cannot exist anymore. Whereas I think Bonnie has not gone...
He does great evil?
Oh yeah, he kills people left, right, and center.
For the ultimate good? Is
for
that
the ultimate
what you're saying?
Good.
Oh, wow.
That's
see,
the
that
whole...
ends justify the means thing. I'm not really sold on.
I'm not sold on it either. I think that creates a very dangerous rule that, as long as the ends are good, whatever I've done is justified. And that's how humanity seems to have been operating for the last 6,000 years.
That's scorched earth policy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But Bonnie isn't there. She really is that tantruming child who has not thought about why she's doing what she's doing, has not actually put in the effort to have any kind of self-discovery. She's just responding. She has, of anything, she is the one who is the example of Calvinism run rampant, where she has no choice, at least from her point of view. She's following a predetermined script from circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And then the doctor says, no, you do have a choice. And that, to me, is why the end of this episode is so excellent. And we'll catch on that when we...
Following on to that, they ask him, you left us with an impossible situation, Doctor. And he says, yes, I know, it's called peace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and yep. It is an impossible situation. Peace really is the one thing that needs to be maintained daily, constantly, mm-hmm. because it's built up of so many various elements that when one falls out of attention, you get imbalance. And once you have imbalance, then you can have destruction.
What was your reaction, Rob, about Kate? Do you think that she was a Zygon when she came back?
I don't think I really worried about it. You know, it's weird, actually, because for some reason, that's one of the times with watching this, I didn't wait. Like, I didn't think about it beforehand.
Mm.
I think I probably would have guessed that she was the real Kate, just because of who she is. If she learned anything from her father, I'm pretty sure she would have known enough about, mm-hmm. What was going on. I kind of figured with the cop right away,
mm-hmm.
that was a Zygon, because I just thought it was weird that why is there one person left, that's working as a sheriff's office, mm-hmm. or whatever.
Now, those hairballs, are they Zygons, or were they humans? Because we saw a Zygon turn into that, too.
I think it's just any biological being gets that reduced into...
That was electrocuted by the Zygons?
Zygons.
That's just, the way that their
thing,
the Death way that ray. Their power worked, I think that's just...
I don't remember that from Terror of the Zygons. Maybe I'm just forgetting.
No, you didn't forget. It's that Stephen Moffat forgot, and he added something new.
Oh, okay.
Yes, they now works. Apparently all have this electrical power that they didn't use at all ever before, even when it could have been useful.
Maybe because it's a new thing. It's a new these are the new Skittles Daleks.
No.
We have these electrocution, emperor style,
It is not Sith Lightning. Sith Lightning is cool. That was
okay. Osgood does explain the new Zygons. I'm going to play that.
Okay.
You need to keep the human original alive to refresh the body print. If you were a Zygon, you would have changed back within days of your sister's death.
Those were the old rules. Before Zygons could pluck loved ones from your memory and wear their faces. Zygons only need to keep the original alive if they need more information from them. If the interrogation is over, then the original can die.
So, do you think she's lying there, Rob?
No. I think she's saying that the Zygons were able to make perfect copies of the memories and everything from the host, if you will, the original.
Okay, if that's the case, then why keep the humans in the pods later on?
Maybe because they didn't do a full transfer yet.
You get the indication that it takes a while, either based off of location or just wearing down the memories. Like, you see Bonnie constantly... interrogating Clara and, mm-hmm. Trying to force her to reveal stuff and even doing the whole little I can feel your heartbeat kind of thing.
I loved that, the lie detector test. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That was really neat.
So while the Zygons might be able to read memories, I think it's only memories that they are given access to. Mm-hmm. How long does it take to know someone? Years.
And Clara is very good at what she divulges and what she isn't. She's very Perry in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I see a lot of parallels between Colin Baker and Perry and their relationship and Peter mm-hmm. Capaldi and Clara. They make a very good team
mm-hmm.
together, whereas Perry would call Colin Baker out mm-hmm. on mm-hmm. so many different things, and Clara does the same thing and infuse him with that we have to do better than this. You know, like in the previous episode, the girl who died. And I think it was very neat to see Clara playing the two. Your take on the two, Rob?
I thought it was awesome. I guess I'll say that I think Jenna kind of made me appreciate her job on the show a little better. Because for the first couple seasons, I was just really getting tired of her. Last season, with the whole thing with Danny, I was like, okay, this is starting to get a little bit... I think she was starting to get more comfortable with her character. This season, I think she's finally figured out who Clara is. And I think that this episode, with the opportunity to play a character off of Clara, maybe helped her to fine-tune it even more. Because, you know, she was able to play not just herself, but somebody discussing things with herself. And I think that just that interaction, like Clara talking to the Zygon self when she was in her in the pod, the whole way they talked to each other and the way that she, well, the way she talked to herself, it just all of a sudden felt much more natural, I think, than she has in the past.
Do you think that they were trying to go for a Trinity look from The Matrix?
Maybe.
I guess a little bit, but I don't know if I would have picked up on it without.
I loved her coat.
Influence.
The coat was nice. The wardrobe selection for this episode or these two episodes has been really spot on, I think. You get someone who knows and understands psychology coming up with a lot of that. Although, not sure how I feel about the Doctor's kind of hoodie-esque appearance this season.
See, I like that. I feel like I could easily wear what he wears this season, so like for me it was fine. I actually kind of like that he's not in the velvet-lined jacket, because instead of being the kind of gruff, like, I've been around for 2,000 years kind of archetypal character, he's a little bit more, he's behaving more human.
He's grungy this season.
Yeah.
And he's still wearing a little star shirt.
Yeah.
Like Morpheus, which we'll, I guess, talk about in the next podcast.
Yeah. But I just, in general, I like, especially with this episode, with his speech, you know, the fact that he didn't look like he wasn't dressed like the president of the world. When he was talking to Kate and Bonnie, he looked like he could have just as easily had his hand on one of the buttons. And I appreciate that.
Or have been drinking tea. And sitting down with some
and he
breakfast
just,
cookies. Or...
Right. He just looked like a person.
Yeah.
I guess. So I appreciated it.
You're almost middle-aged, Rob, right?
Yeah.
And you're almost middle-aged, Peter?
Yep.
I guess I'm about middle-aged. And Clara says that everybody middle-aged thinks that the world is coming to an end. It never does.
Yeah.
No.
I thought it was a funny little throwaway line.
Yeah.
It just stuck out that, I guess, because the world is so different from when I was a kid.
Right.
When I was a kid, heck, we had the Cold War and we... You know,
we were afraid of the world really ending.
Yeah, we went through drills. Not just we didn't do the under the desk thing. We did in the archways of the building and that kind of thing. It was a very different world in the early 80s with Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan at the helm.
I think, although, again, that shows that difference between the choices we have between living in despair and living in hope. That line of everyone middle-aged thinks the world is coming to an end. Well, why is that? Is it because most people in their middle ages, middle-aged years, whatever you want to phrase it as, because they've hit that age of testing that they start worrying about things falling apart?
I think we're more worried about what's going to happen in the generation before or after us.
Yeah.
Continuing on our traditions, our way of thought, and not realizing. I know for myself, I look at a lot of kids and be like, don't you understand? Don't you get it? And a lot of times they do, but no, people aren't, you know, on the same self-inspection and curve, I guess, that I've put myself on. And I mean, my opinions have changed so much over the years. I can't judge anyone's opinions and say that they're not right. I guess because I've gone through those opinions myself. And so I just be calling myself out.
Over the summer, I attended an awesome conference from the Biologos Foundation. And at the end of the conference, as I was heading out of the hall where we had been meeting, I saw one of the kids who had been the host serving, you know, bringing the food, bringing the drinks to my table throughout the conference. And so I stopped and I said, you know, thank you. And I was just kind of chatting with him a little bit. And as we got to talking, there was such hope and optimism in his voice. I actually had to say at the end of it, thank you for giving me hope that the next generation has possibility, because he had such great potential. And I don't see that in a lot of the youth I interact with. Some of them, there's great potential, and then others just seem to be coasting. But those few bright spots, I'm hoping there's more than just a few, and that they will ignite into something better.
I just always have to think. I mean, nothing's new, really. We had the same kids that I grew up with that that are now that are like sort of more concerned about their phones and about daddy giving them this or daddy giving them that, and in our Western society, and less concerned about the basics, food, shelter, clothing, you know, kind of thing. And then a lot of those, we have what, 5% who go off to war, who become in the military somehow, and I always think of their sacrifice and what are we doing? You know, we're complaining about this or that, you know, when we're not stuck in a sand pit somewhere.
Yeah.
And then there's so many great kids. I love to hear how they're evolving, how their mind is thinking, because it is so different than what I'm used to. And that's why another reason why I love meeting new people, I guess. Now, you get a lot of that in your line of work, Rob, where you just meet everybody all day. You work in a customer service kind of...
Yeah. I say fortunately, but it's kind of mixed bag. But for the last year, the new place that I'm at, I don't have as much of that, unfortunately. It is actually unfortunate. As much as I claim to be an introvert and that I don't like talking to new people, I kind of realized this past week after attending the Mennonite Church USA Franconia Conference business meeting. I had to go as a delegate. And by the time I was talking to my pastor after it, I was like, you know, I think I have to finally admit that there is a part of me that enjoys being shoved into a situation that I'm not comfortable with. Probably a really big mistake to say that to my pastor, but, it's funny to actually, to go back into what you were saying about, just youth and trying to lead them along our path. Earlier in the week, my son actually said to me, he's who, by the way, is like, he loves playing video games, he loves being inside, he, you know, he's always talked about, I like being inside, I don't like being outside. All of a sudden this past week, he goes, you know what, I want it to get nice out again, because I can't wait to go outside and be in the naturist places. I'm like, you what? And he's like, I want to go outside. He's like, I want to be outside. And I'm like, well, why? And he said, well, because I listened to what Pastor Tim said at his one message a couple weeks ago about being out in nature and getting to learn about God. And I'm like, I'm like, dude, you're 8 years old and you just said that? He has no idea that he's already fulfilling the reason I gave him the name that I did. I named him Leto because of the Dune books, where actually comes from the third book, where the character Paul says, I'm going to name my son Leto because he didn't name him Leto because he wanted him to do this, but the idea behind their relationship was that Paul was supposed to be a messiah, if you will, for the lack of a better term. He decided that he could not fulfill the things that he had to do that. Because of his love for his wife, his love for his children, he wasn't willing to sacrifice himself and to do the things that had to be done. And so his dying wish, basically, for his son was that he would be able to train his son in such a way that his son would be willing to make that sacrifice and to do the thing that needed to be done to save the world, for the lack of a better explanation. And so to see Leto go from loving video games and doing all this stuff, which I've kind of raised him in, to now all of a sudden he's...
More like his uncle?
Yeah, yeah. And it just, I loved it because it just felt like... Like, yes, he's getting it already. Like, he's hearing things and making up his own mind and choosing to do things differently. Like, a couple months ago, he was all like, I love video games, I hate being outside. Like, we'd be like, okay, we're going to go over to Pyramid Mountain, and he'd be like, oh, I don't want to go outside, I don't want to play video games.
And,
like,
and kids go through all those phases. Well, yeah. I mean, as adults, we go through those phases.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about identity. It's about gaining an identity and having self-realization and what you like and what you don't. And different flavors. You're supposed to taste the world, to discover something. I'll try anything once or twice, just to see. I mean, hard drugs or something like that, but something stupid. But and Peter, you're right along those same lines with your new task that you just kind of fell into. Yeah. Peter's.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I heard about that. That's pretty awesome. When I read your post about that.
What's your official title?
Oh,
as your warden,
the trail warden for High Mountain State Park.
Right.
Yeah,
that's really cool.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun just to be outdoors, and I have a title. No paycheck because it's all volunteer. But I have a title for the thing that I was doing for really the last 15-20 years anyway.
Hmm.
Just walking around in nature and trying to be a steward.
Requiring shrubberies from passerby.
Cutting down trees with a herring. It's a little harder to do.
The norm.
Yeah, better when the herring is frozen, I have to admit.
So we had the cliffhanger at the end of the Zygon invasion.
Yeah.
And that was Bonnie actually trying to shoot down the Doctor's plane, and that caused a lot of controversy. Big controversy.
Controversy. Yeah.
Controversy. Because of the Russian plane that...
Right,
got shut down. So, everything is sort of political in this two-part episode. I don't know if they really wanted it to be. Whereas the last few episodes seem more philosophical and spiritual in nature, religious in nature. This one definitely took on a more political slant, which is something that Peter Capaldi recently told, I think, Cult UK, Cult Box, that he wanted to be more John Pertwee-esque. In some of the writing style, where things did have more of a political slant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where Joe Grant in The Green Death, that kind of thing, where they took on major issues, and his issue that he wants to take on is fracking.
Hmm.
So I really don't like that Pertwee kind of thing, because it becomes time-sensitive, where that thing isn't really an issue now.
Right.
So let's keep it more in like the Twilight Zone does, where these are truths that...
Universal truths.
Right. Mm-hmm. Where have more of a timelessness to the story.
Because
it'll show the age of the story.
That's why Shakespeare is so powerful today and so multicultural, even though he's writing stuff that is set in a particular time and place, like, you know, Venice or Vienna or any of the other places... with the exception of his historical dramas. And even those are still echoing today. Like, I get so much out of Julius Caesar or Henry V, much more than I do almost any other kind of writing, unless they're able to tap into that human nature element. Because no matter what, there is nothing new under the sun. Human nature has not really changed in the thousands of years that we have been writing it down.
And see, that's what kind of annoys me about this kind of story, even though I thought this, both these two-parters, the two-part story, this was incredible.
Mm-hmm.
But when I go to watch Doctor Who, it's sort of an escapism for me. Right. I don't want to be reminded about the problems of the day. I want to be able to sit back and have those things forgotten about. And there's something to be said for that. I have basically two genres of literature in my library. One is theology and philosophy, and the other is fantasy. And I enjoy having, and I gulp down the fantasy more than I do the philosophy and theology, only because I need more of that escapism than thinking about these big, huge issues.
Right.
So how is your thought on that, Peter? I mean, Rob? Peter was about to speak.
I was.
I'll let you go for it.
All right. There is something to say about escapism. You know, I have a couple of escapist novels myself where I'll read them and enjoy them as I'm reading it. But every escapist novel that I've ever read, I set it down and I've never picked it up again.
Hmm.
It's cool. It's neat. It takes me out of my world for a moment. And that's one of the elements that I do with my LARPs, going out and just camping out in the woods with my friends and living a different life for a weekend. It disassociates me from my 9-to-5 Monday through Friday kind of world, or, well, at that time, it was really Sunday through Sunday when I wasn't escaping. But all of the stories that I reread, Tolkien especially, or some of the others, they have those timeless elements to it where it's bringing me back not to a set moment in time, but to that human condition. And that's why I read them over and over again, because there's something new as I grow and I reread the story again. I can read it through new eyes. I don't know how many times anymore I've read the Lord of the Rings trilogy. I tend to read it about every 2 years, so I guess we're somewhere in around the tune of 20-something times having read it. But it's new each time. I'm still picking up stuff decades later. Not quite to the same level as Scripture, but Scripture also speaks to those eternal human elements. The story of David, even though David and I are very different from one another, I still get new elements of, in David's life, stuff that I need to think of in my own life.
Rob?
I could really... I think usually when I watch Doctor Who, or most science fiction, I think I go into it with the intent of using it as escapism. I watch it because I want to get my mind off of what's going on. But I think a lot of the time, especially with Doctor Who and certain other science fiction movies and stuff, I end up getting to the other side of it, where I end up saying, like, oh, but I can see where I could pull things out of that for my life. Like this episode, for instance. When I started watching the Zygon episode, I'm like, it's Doctor Who. It's about the Zygons. You know, we've seen them before. They started off with a little flashback to the anniversary episode and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then as it went on, just more and more, I found myself sitting there saying, like, this, the Doctor's speech is a blog post I could have written.
Yeah.
You know, and I just see...
The term splinter group was used.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, there have been plenty of other times where that happened as well. Like I said, as far as, you know, Dune. When I first started reading Dune and the original Dune series, I had no idea that it would affect me the way it has.
Mm.
Even more recent stories that I've read, a book series my sister gave me to read recently, was just, she's like, oh, you like science fiction. This sounds like something you might like. And I read it, and, you know, I read it with the intent to just read a fun science fiction book, and...
Mm-hmm.
It changes. Maybe I'm just too open to, like, you know, suggestion from books or something like that, mm-hmm. or stories, maybe.
Well, they imprint you for a reason, where mm-hmm. you're at, just like mm-hmm. Peter was saying. That's what I find funny about people saying, oh, the Bible changes every time I read mm-hmm. it. Well, yeah, you're changing. The Bible hasn't changed.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, that's why, yeah, I was going to say, when I was at this conference, the business meeting last weekend, we were given tables where 7 people who usually don't know each other had to sit down, and we had to go over these discussion points that we had to vote on for the business. And it came up a bunch of times that we were talking about whether Scripture supports what we're doing or not. And ultimately, to kind of cut it a little bit short, this may lose a little bit of the detail, but I came down to, we all kind of agreed at our table that sometimes maybe the Bible is just a little bit vague for the sake of having to go back to it, so that we can discuss it.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I think I may have even mentioned it in the last episode that we recorded, where, you know, if things that we read were just black and white, this is the story it's telling you, we would read it once, say, there it is,
mm-hmm.
just it's plain and simple, put it back on the shelf, and never touch it again.
Yeah.
So when we see... living books, right? Because a lot of time people refer to the Bible as the living word of God.
Mm-hmm.
It's, again, not so much that the Bible is living, but that we are changing. And because of the mm-hmm. way that the Bible is vague, if you will, or veiled, it forces us to read something, to question it, to talk mm-hmm. to somebody.
Or to see what you want to see.
Or a lot of people do use it to see what they want to see. But mm-hmm. I think the intent that the proper use of it, I think, would be to read it, to not to not force yourself to understand it a certain way, but then to take what you see in it, to talk to other people about it, and then to maybe go back over it together and to see it and to think about it and to spend time thinking about it, not to just take it, not to look at the Ten Commandments, read it for what it is, write it down and say, this is the rule, put it out like that, and then just apply that point blank with no discussion. Because if you do that, then you never have to pick it up again.
Mm-hmm. There's a reason why I have never read Dick and Jane after, I think it was kindergarten that I was exposed to.
Because you know what it has to say.
Exactly. There's no group that meets together to discuss Dick and Jane.
Yeah.
There are groups that will get together and discuss Rudyard Kipling, that'll discuss, Dr. Seuss.
Yep.
So many people will look at Dr.
Seuss.
Dr. Seuss.
I knew what he was saying. I figured he was just throwing a German accent into it.
Yeah, we're going to go with that. Yeah, sure. But no. People will read those as adults, not just to their kids, but sometimes some of my friends will reopen it myself. I've got some from my childhood that I'll just reread again because it's not static.
Right.
It is a dynamic and vague enough that I can still find inspiration through its words no matter where I am in my life.
Well, and that's actually one of the things I think that's beautiful about Dr. Seuss particularly is that when you... We all look at him and that he wrote them for kids, right? But then, for instance, The Lorax.
Yeah.
It's being told from the perspective of the adult in the story.
Yep.
You know, and then there, at the end of the book, you get the whole thing where the adult who is telling the story is, trying to instruct that the youth hearing the story learns from it.
Yeah.
And at the same time, through the course of the story, you see where the adult learned the lesson. Where they made the mistake and they want to share the mistake they made and to instruct the next generation. And, as the parent reading it to the child, you can't help but sit there and say, holy crap.
Yeah. No, as a youth pastor, one of the things that I always want to do is get the seniors of my church and the youth of my church to interact. Because there's so much that the kids can give to the adults and the adults can give to the kids that they don't realize unless they actually get into the same room and start talking.
Right. Well, that's the sad part, too, about how our society these days, we've thrown out this whole concept of, apprenticeship.
Yeah.
Not just because of the idea of passing down a skill, but the interaction that people had. You know, when you're a 12-year-old, you're just waiting for the world to show itself to you. And if you're just sitting there by yourself trying to figure it out, most of the time, you're probably going to end up with some pretty screwed up ideas.
Which they do.
So, but that's...
And some people carry that into their 30s and 40s and much longer.
Yeah. And I think that's the problem, is that again, that comes back to this idea of, being middle-aged or older.
Have all this from a throwaway line.
Yeah, I know. Well, but
those are the best lines.
I think oftentimes the reason why so many middle-aged people question, look at it so doomsday-like, I think, is because of the way that our society has changed. So many middle-aged people these days never got the interaction.
Yeah.
How many people that are middle-aged or even, a little bit older than us, like the generation before, how often were kids told, do as I say, only speak when spoken to, young people weren't allowed to give input.
Oh, the world has definitely changed over the last 100 years in that regard. Mm-hmm. Children were shipped off to work camps and child labor.
Even boarding
places.
Schools and things like that.
Exactly.
They didn't have personal
and
interaction.
A lot of times they weren't part of their whole family interaction. Especially in Britain, you'll have that whole Oliver kind of thing where a stipend was given from an uncle.
Right.
And you were supposed to, find yourself and become the banker that he wanted you to be.
And some of that's also just an element of that culture and time. There were just so many children because the people still had the mentality of, we have to breed, we have to breed, we have to breed. And so you'd have 12 kids.
Every sperm is sacred?
Yeah. Yeah. As our medical and hygienic and other elements of life have improved, we've realized that we can move away from that to some degree. Not as much as I think our culture is sliding into today. We're going to regret in the next couple of decades some of the lackadaisical nature that we have to reproduction. That already starting now, where adults are having children in their 40s and realizing that they just don't have the energy to keep up with a six-year-old when you're 45 as you did when you're 25.
I can't speak to that because I have more energy now than I ever had.
Well, but you also made a life change to take care of yourself better.
Yes, I did.
You know, when you had your stroke, that was a wake-up call for you.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and that's the point, though, is that you are doing everything that you can to be different and to make a change like that.
I don't want to end up in a box.
Yeah.
Anytime soon.
Yeah, exactly. So.
Because I love myself.
That's the way it should be.
Moving on. Dr. John Disco.
Yeah.
Dr. Funkenstein.
Yeah. I was trying to figure out what the deal with that was because, you know, him and the music seems to be a thing this season. Obviously, you know, not just the, you know, playing Amazing Grace at the beginning, but, yeah, just throwing all that other stuff in there. I got a kick out of it.
There's a lot of, like, little things thrown in here. Five Rounds Rapid was the Brigadier's, what he said in The Demons.
Yep.
Oh, that's where that came from. Okay.
Yeah.
I knew it had to have some kind of significance just the way that he said it, but I hadn't caught that.
Yeah, it was from Nicholas Courtney.
Okay.
So she said the same thing. Yeah. Osgood is smart.
Yes.
Osgood is very smart. As Clara is using Bonnie's thumb to text, I'm going to play this clip.
No. Not was. Is. It's not from the Zygon, it's from Clara.
How?
She's not dead. She's in a pod somewhere. They need a live feed to the information in her brain, but she's fighting back. She's trying to take control piece by piece.
Texting.
How much more human do you get? Well, the Zygon probably doesn't even know it sent this, or why it misfired that bazooka.
You don't know, it's just a theory.
Yes, it's just a theory. But how's that hope phase now?
Worse than ever.
Then we've got a game.
Now, the only thing I wanted to pick on about that... Do you realize how impossible it is to text on a touchscreen-only phone without looking at the screen? It is amazing that the doctor even was able to read anything, let alone the fact that she even got to the screen to be able to place a text message.
Yeah.
Clara knows her phone that well.
I don't know. I just got to...
Having worked with teenagers... as much as I have, and of anyone on this planet who are more attached to technology, I cannot think than teenagers. But they still misdial and mishit all the time, and they're looking at the screen. So
my phone doesn't cooperate with my. But then again, my phone is years and years old. But I'd have to hit. I have to go through the letters, 1, 2, 3, to get to the T.
But see, at least, with the older phones, when I had that, you could at least still, you know, you felt the spaces and the keys.
Yeah.
I mean, we're overanalyzing.
We are.
I know, but it's just, but even so, to bring it back to the part of the episode, I thought it was neat how there had to be such a connection. Like you said, that Osgood picked up on the fact that there was that kind of connection between Clara and... The Zygon, you know, between Bonnie, that, you know, she could, you know, kind of almost use the Force and close her eyes and, you know, like imagine
texting. Which leads me to believe that this is the Zygon Osgood.
Yeah, I was thinking that, too, when she got into this, talking about how... Because she knows an awful lot of detail about how Zygons work. So either the transfer of that knowledge, maybe when Osgood... Because as Peter, you said before, that seemed like it had to be given... Like, they have to give the permission for them to know those things. Maybe it works both ways.
It might work both ways, or just the relationship that they had. You know, it's so much a description of being intimate with either, like, a sibling or with a spouse. That kind of utter trust. So, in a way, I think... the Osgood is a hybrid, but not necessarily a biological one. It's a mental.
Right.
She is neither human nor Zygon anymore. Mm-hmm. She is whatever we want to call it.
And, you know, it may even be one of those situations where...
Zoom in.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It may even be one of those situations where she doesn't even know.
Yeah.
Right? How many times do we see that kind of trope in science fiction where, you know, if mm-hmm. you have one of these things where there's a real... the original of something and a copy of something.
Yeah.
And when you spend so much time trying to say that it doesn't matter, that you both forget which one is mm-hmm. which. So who knows? Maybe... Yeah. And maybe that's the point. Maybe mm-hmm. she doesn't even know. Maybe that's why she's so cryptic with the doctor about it.
Yeah. Oh, that's like the android thinking that it's human. Really
exactly.
Human.
Yeah, the idea of like implanted dreams and stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, think of like Philip K. Dick kind of stuff, mm-hmm. Where the robot forgets it's a robot.
Or that she has just gotten to the point where it ceased to matter. Not mm-hmm. so much that she's not sure anymore, but that she mm-hmm. has... lost the care of what it mm-hmm. meant to be one race or
right.
the other.
Yeah.
Well, see, that's sort of the driving force of this episode, too, is that Bonnie wants the Zygons unmasked to basically be themselves. Mm-hmm. Hey, we're all Zygons. Mm-hmm. We're these big, puffy things with suckers yeah. on her. Rather than the shape-shifting, we're human beings, mm-hmm. and then forgetting that they are something Zygon, different. And then interbreeding mm-hmm. so much that it's lost.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's an old... trope within mythology.
Another genetic purity kind of thing.
Not mm-hmm. just genetic purity, but a warning for shapeshifters, you know. Don't play being the bear so much that you forget what it is to be human and become a bear. Mm-hmm. There's an old Greek story of a wizard who became a bear and mm-hmm. lost himself and ended up mauling his own children mm-hmm. without realizing it because he was just a bear. He had ceased to be the man. And so there's a little bit of that we need racial purity or stuff, but then there's also that idea of you are who you are and wearing a mask. There's a term in Jungian psychology whose name escapes me, but it starts with an A. And it's basically when you wear a repressive persona of your true self for so long, a reaction will begin to occur because you're repressing your true self so much. When it starts to reassert itself, it can be a violent and dangerous process where, you know, someone who constantly is in the closet or whatever we want to use as the metaphor for this, eventually something's going to happen where they have to be themselves, and if they aren't, then either they start to die and it's destructive to them, or the true self will burst out in a radical or violent means and they become aggressive or they become melancholy or they become disassociated and it causes deep issues later on.
Well, we also see that in folklore when it comes to the wild man
yeah.
kind of idea of mm-hmm. becoming part of the trees, the ground, the earth,
mm-hmm.
bracken and branch.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we see that in some of the Merlin tales.
Yep.
And he has to come back from that after mm-hmm. being that. And it's also in scripture with Nebuchadnezzar
yeah.
as mm-hmm. well, where he becomes the wild man mm-hmm. for a time and then comes back mm-hmm. to his kingdom.
Mm-hmm. Better than what he was before because he's learned true humility through
it. And it's that journey. That's the important thing mm-hmm. is going through that to learn
yeah.
and to accept you for who you are, too, mm-hmm, I think, mm-hmm. a lot of times. So maybe it has a lot of those layers in folklore.
Yeah.
So I thought it was interesting that Bonnie, one of Bonnie's main thrusts is for the Zygon just to wear their own skin. You know, thankfully, we don't have the stupid gas exchange or anything,
yeah.
just mm-hmm. like in the Eccleston time.
Well, that was also the... Slovene, anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, but I agree
right.
that there was nothing...
The same kind of thing.
There was no kind of, like, comedic...
They weren't wearing suits,
relief
though.
To it, yeah.
Right. So there's a button that unmasks every one of them, which turns out that button doesn't really unmask mm-hmm. every one of them. And I don't know if she would have wanted that anyway. Because those people did not... The first one, K-Zero, or what,
mm-hmm.
He did not want to be unmasked and
right.
killed himself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For it.
Right.
Yeah.
And he was happy to live and work and mm-hmm. be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so what she was really trying to do was trying to get to where they are now, but in their skins that they aren't wearing,
mm-hmm.
which just seems kind of redundant
mm-hmm.
if that's what she really wanted. But like you were saying, maybe that's because you have to be who you are and you yeah. want to be accepted the way you are, not forced into this other shape.
What worked for her does not work for him, and what mm-hmm. works for him does not work for her. And one element of extremism that is the most dangerous is this idea of yourself, therefore, must be true for everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what makes extremism so dangerous, is you have lost your relatability to others.
Mm-hmm.
So that somebody says, no, that doesn't work for me, can't fit within your paradigm anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why she was as dangerous as she was, and why it's a human condition element, because too many people make that mistake. They don't realize that, no, some things are meant to be broad and gray because there's diversity
mm-hmm.
for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
Osgood's name was, the doctor's called Basil. I guess that's Basil Fawlty, maybe
I was trying to think if that was what it was or not, but
Basil.
There wasn't really anything else that kind of tied it in.
And Osgood is Petronella,
mm-hmm.
Which is, of course, Petra is rock, but also did some research on Petronella. Traditionally, she's the daughter of St. Peter,
yep.
and she's the virgin martyr. So beautiful that she was locked away in a tower, sort of like Rapunzel.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
Neat the way some writers name. I want to play the two audio clips. The doctor called the Z-67 the imbecile's gas.
Mm-hmm.
And here's why.
This is the moment we've all been waiting for.
Make your mind up, Tyre. One of those buttons will destroy the Zygons. Release the imbecile's gas.
Harry. Will you try to undo this?
Well, naturally.
Did you make the rocks fall, Harry?
Well, I suppose I must have done, yes.
Harry Sullivan is an imbecile!
And there you go, from Tom Baker's mouth.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Why does peacekeeping always involve killing?
Because everybody thinks that they have to eradicate the... Oh, what's the word? I'm trying to think. I can't even think of the term to use for it. But basically, people think that, you know, if there is a rogue unit within established peace, that they have to eradicate that mm-hmm. instead of trying to assimilate it.
Some of it is also fear. Can we assimilate some things? And people are worried that it's so different that it could not possibly, you know, because that requires them to change as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think that causes a lot of fear. You know, why does peacekeeping require killing? I've done a few funerals as a pastor, and they're always really, really hard and difficult. One of the most recent ones that I did was a few years ago, and two of my friends... one of their twins was born dead, stillborn. When we had the funeral for it, I reminded the audience that death is here for a reason. Horrible things happen to make us respond to them. We as humans, when things are happy, when things are good, we get complacent, we get lazy, we get useless.
Pain is God's megaphone?
Yeah. I think that's why sin exists in this world. Why there is death and suffering. It's not good. It's not happy. But it is, to an extent, necessary. It makes us look outside of ourselves for the first time in a long while. And when you see someone crying, you know, why does the doctor always stop for crying children? I don't think it's really just crying children. It's anyone who's crying. He looks outside of himself so much that he cannot help but empathize with anyone who who is sad. Children affect him greatly, but anybody who is sad is going to get a visit from the doctor, one way or the other, because he is the embodiment of that empathy, that looking outside ourselves, of wanting to make it right. And the only way that we can make something right is when we have something that unites us. So death is a part of peace. It is not the end result. I think it's the first step. It gives us something to respond to. It's the call to the journey. Peace is this process, this journey that we will enter on. It's the quest. At first we may reject it, but I think anyone who is able to look outside themselves will eventually hear that call and start following it.
Mine is much simpler. I think we're so focused on peacekeeping that we're not peacemaking. And we're not trained in peacemaking. Unfortunately, we're trained in peacekeeping. It's how discipline works. And unfortunately, I think as adults, we have to move away from peacekeeping and be more focused on peacemaking and how two sides can come to a table and get it out like rational human beings without anger or aggression. If we always turn to aggression as the peacekeeping method, it's always going to continue. That is a vicious cycle because you're always going to be killing someone who's going, or a member of someone's family who's then going to become your enemy again. You kill my father. My name is Inigo Montoya, you know.
Exactly.
It's just the way it works. And I think, you know, we as the West and Britain as well, and France just learned too, because actually nobody's talking about it, but Syria was their colony. Unfortunately, it's when that rule of peacekeeping happens that we end up getting bit in the ass, because we're supposed to be peacemaking and providing consequences. Providing inroads for producing violins.
Right. Well, I thought it was it's neat because a couple of weeks ago I watched a short documentary on YouTube, I think, of a maximum security prison out in, I want to say, Louisiana, where they started it off where I was kind of offended by it, because at first they presented it just, this is a maximum security prison, and they have basically a plantation that they're running out of it. And I was like, what is this? I was getting mad at first. But then as the documentary went on, they introduced men that were in this prison. A lot of them either in there for life, or some of them were on death row. And to jump right to the end of it, ultimately what came down to was a lot of the men inside this prison were now working inside the prison, going to, you know, they were getting schooling for automotive mechanics and things like that, different schooling for agriculture and all this kind of stuff. And they had men that were working with them, kind of bringing back to what we were saying about raising up the next generation. The tagline at the end of the documentary was basically, why do we have to wait until these men have committed the crimes that caused them to be in this prison before we address the issue and make the peace in their lives by training them to do something that makes them beneficial to society? Not just because they're a benefit to society, but because for them, it gives them value that they didn't have before they learned these things. And I said, so where we spend all this money, I mean, not to get into the American penal system, but we spend all this money to keep the peace by putting people in prison and to keep them there, as opposed to what if all of that effort was used before those are committed to ensure that people had somebody to show them that they have value, and that, you know, we did things to breed that into them.
Oh, that's
earlier
a popular topic within libertarian circles, definitely, and also Democrat circles for the most part. Republicans don't usually talk about that kind of thing. Now, I know those of us, those of you across the pond, are from different countries. Political things on the America and the two parties that dominate it are. Anyway,
They're not as honest as they should be.
No, yeah. And unfortunately, there is a huge line of poverty in this country that is only looked on when it comes to the negative attention that a child would have, basically, to make an analogy. And I mean, there is something to be said about people being free to do whatever the heck they want to do until they break that law, cross that line. Right. But at the same time, we are putting a ton of money into education. Yeah. And not getting anything out of it. Now, some of that is partly to do with the teachers' unions and the way that our educational system is set up, unfortunately, where we just think that we're going to throw money into something that's going to fix the problem, and you're never actually addressing the problem. So there has to be an administrative flip on, hey, let's actually try to fix the problem instead of getting our paycheck every week. I know there are people who, that don't fit into that, and, and I'm making a generalization. But and there are a lot of people who want to do what you're talking about with the prison system. Unfortunately, we have so many laws on the books now, too, that most people commit two or three felonies a day without even thinking about it, without even knowing. So it just becomes a haphazard when you're going to get cited for something, almost. We're the most incarcerated nation in the world for all our freedom. And a lot of times it comes down in poorer areas, in areas where there is that poverty line, where there's more of a focus on incarceration.
And yet out of those depressed areas, you still end up getting really interesting stories, you know, the one brother who becomes the drug addict, drug dealer, and the other one who becomes the doctor. And again, it's the circumstances may be crap, but the choices and responses that we have to those circumstances are still on us as well.
I agree.
So while I agree that there needs to be a really a radical reformation of how this country treats people and the imbalance and inequality and disenfranchisement, there also is that element of the self. I am the master of my own destiny. What I choose is going to be what I choose. So, you know, I
for a
cannot,
second I thought you were going to say your own domain.
Oh, that too. But, you know, you cannot simply blame the system. There's going to also have to be some self-incrimination that, that echoes throughout people. And we need a little bit of a mixture of that. We need society to become culpable and or accountable for its culpability. And we need the individual to also realize that they have an accountability that they have not reached in their potential. There's a lot of stuff that I know I have squandered in my lifetime that I wish I could hit a reset button and do over again from a very young age. But our past shapes us. And that, I think, is important as well to remember. You know, what were my circumstances at that time? How do I respond to it? And I think that was probably one of the most important reasons for why the doctor did not wipe the memory of Bonnie. She needed to remember. Because without that memory, she could not have become who she becomes. She could not have become the new Osgood.
And she also knew the doctor forgave her.
Yeah.
I was very proud of Kate when she closed her box.
Yeah.
To be the one to do it first.
Rob, do you think that the Brigadier would have closed his box?
I like to believe he would have in that situation. Because there were times, because he, you know, his relationship with the doctor was just such that I think if he was in that situation with the doctor, that he would have seen it and he would have understood.
Okay, doctor, we'll do it your way.
Exactly. He said that plenty of times. Maybe not in the exact same situation where they were face-to-face with, you know, basically ultimate destruction. But there were plenty of times where he definitely stepped down and listened to what the doctor had to say. And I think he would have done the same there.
I think that Kate actually was channeling her dad here because the doctor says that no one should have to feel this pain. Not on my watch. And then she says, when she closes it, I'm sorry. Like she realizes it just came all of a sudden. She realized exactly who he was and what he was talking about. Right. And like her father there too inside of her. I mean, and interestingly enough, I grew up in very much the same way, mm-hmm. where I have a very military-minded parent who was Special Forces, Green Beret, and was raised in that mm-hmm. setting, was raised in that mentality. And so I can see the effects, and that's what mm-hmm. she was saying, I'm sorry. Because this is also a episode during Remembrance Week and during Veterans Day. And last right. year we had the Danny episode, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which was honoring those who had fallen. And this time we have veterans who are undergoing some kind of PTSD for the yep. most part. And the doctor has those every time I close my eyes. And so that's what I grew up with. And yep. I realize exactly what he's talking about. And not because it happened to me, but because I see the effects. See
yeah.
So it hit home mm-hmm. very hard with that speech mm-hmm. for me. Peter, why do you think a Shielder's helmet, the Meyer helmet, was in the background?
I had noticed that it was in the background. I just thought it was another element of the Black Vault. I didn't give it too much thought. I think partly because I was just too wrapped up in some of my own emotions as I was processing through that scene. But it now that I'm thinking on it, it might be giving us the potential for hope, because it looks back to what we were talking about our last episode, you know, consequences, and if we don't maintain growth, you know, if we just, okay, we fixed it and we walk away, and then, you know, stuff is going to spiral out of control, just like a shield has spiraled out of control without realizing. You know, the doctor was just not there, and he didn't see for hundreds of years the pain she was going through. So I think that might be a subtle hint of today is closing, but what are you going to do tomorrow?
Rob, any thoughts on the Meyer helmet in the background? The whole time during this
anti-war
speech?
Yeah, I noticed it right away. What I was trying to remember, not so much that was there, but I was trying to remember what that little closed-off room was for specifically. Because if I remember correctly, that room was like a almost like a separate dimension within the room. It wasn't literally, they didn't explain it like that. But for some reason, I think I remember that the previous episode we were in the vault, that room was even more isolated than the rest of it. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember what story it was specifically where they were in there before.
Well, it was Day of the Doctor, where he couldn't bring the TARDIS into the vault for whatever protections
that they
had.
I know the vault is blocked, but even that small chamber that the helmet was in, there was something different about that chamber even. And I was trying to, I mean, I guess I could have gone back and tried to watch the previous episode.
I think that was the chamber that had the alien tech in it.
Yeah.
And there was like wraparound corners, I guess, with sort of like pull-out shelving where there was other things inside of it. Mm-hmm. And then there was the pictures of the old companions on the board behind them.
Yeah.
And old doctors and things.
It got put there recently.
What did?
The helmet had to get put there recently.
Yeah.
Maybe, yeah. The doctor might have carried it on the boat from the Vikings and put it there. Because mm-hmm. that was the shield, a shielder's helmet for mm-hmm. the dreams.
Right.
Or the, not the dreams, the...
Her projection.
Right,
of
Well, what I mean is that I'm going to get a little bit too deep into the... More deep than we need to for this point, but it wasn't there in the previous episode where they were in the Black Vault.
Mm-hmm. No.
So a shielder brought it in between...
No, the doctor brought it in.
Date. Well, maybe. Maybe not.
Maybe not.
Someone brought it in.
Yeah, someone. Yeah. We don't know who.
So.
And we're also not guaranteed that was the helmet that we saw. It could have been another.
It also might have just been because they needed, maybe there was something on the back wall on the stage, and they had to block it, and they decided, well, we have this big prop helmet. We'll just
from
that
a props
there.
Department.
Yeah,
you grab whatever is big and bulky, and will fill the need.
Yeah.
And then you're also doing something that's going to be more recent, mm-hmm. Just because if you're doing a long running show, it would not have been useful, for example, that to have been a Mayan or Aztec headdress. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't have registered with the recent viewers.
Plus, at the same time, maybe this was a little bit of trying to say that the doctor was also thinking about her in this process.
Mm-hmm.
the process of the discussion of, you know, looking at the conversation he had with Ashilda at the restaurant, you know, at the inn. Maybe he was thinking of her and just her story at the same time. Mm-hmm. And that was just a way of kind of reminding us about her story. Yeah. And her feelings about, you know, losing her identity. Mm-hmm. And wanting to refine her and, you know, finding her identity again.
Yeah.
In the same way he was talking to Bonnie, and Bonnie wanted everybody to be exposed for what they really were.
Mm-hmm.
I have one final clip.
Mm-hmm. You didn't wipe my memory.
Mm.
No. Just Kate's. Oh, and your little friends here. Of course. When they wake up, they won't remember what you've done. It'll be our secret.
You're going to protect me.
You're one of us now, whether you like it or not.
I don't understand how you could just forgive me.
Because I've been where you have. There was another box. I was going to press another button. I was going to wipe out all of my own kind. Man, woman, and child, I was so sure I was right.
What happened?
Same thing that happened to you. I let Clara Oswald get inside my head. Trust me. She doesn't leave.
Gotta love it. Mm-hmm. I know people can't wait for Clara to leave, but she's grown on me. Gotta admit. She's really, her character has developed over the years, and I think from, that was her thinking, hey, there's three doctors here in the Day of the Doctor. There's three of you here. I mean, come on, put your heads together, guys.
Mm-hmm.
And to rethink or to change your mind just means.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep.
In a way, Clara is the Doctor's conscious, more so than almost any other companion that I've seen, where she's really constantly holding up a mirror to him.
Yeah.
But for a very, very good and insightful way. It's neat to see, as she's gotten bolder in her characteristic, as the actress has just gotten bolder, how much better she is at doing that.
Yeah, and we've suffered through companions who were bumblers and mm-hmm. who always did the opposite. And I think, as a classic Doctor Who fan, I really appreciate Clara.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've been through those mm-hmm. that you just wanted to just go away, please just go away. The Victorias or Susan mm-hmm. Formans or Mel. Just some really, really Adric, Turlough. Just mm-hmm. some really bad companions who were sometimes even fighting against him.
Mm-hmm.
Some just doing what they wanted to do and not caring, and just for the story's sake. And this time we have someone who's smart, who is that good wife who spurns him onward. Yeah.
This calls him on it.
Yeah.
It's a relationship. It's an equal relationship, and that's important. Most of the bumbling ones, or those who are fighting, Adric, for example, tried too much to be his own person separate from the Doctor. There was no real equal relationship. There was no give and take between the two. Mm-hmm. The Doctor was trying to be a mentor, and he was being your typical teenager who resists being mentored because he wants to do it on his own.
And he was also brought up as sort of royalty, too, sort of a prince of that yeah. culture through Full Circle, his first mm-hmm. episode.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. He and his brother.
So, but this one, we've seen romantic subplots for Doctors. Even Clara seemed to have a little bit of a romantic subplot with Matt Smith. But here, rather than a romantic relationship, this is kind of what Missy was talking about, getting outside of just the sexualness mm-hmm. of a relationship. This is a real equal marriage, in a way. The Doctor and his wife.
And he even hugs her.
Yeah. mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not just to hide his face either.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Because I really think that he appreciates her. Even if she throws away every key from the TARDIS in a dream where she can be bitchy too. She can, but he allows that, you know, which is, it's a good relationship that they have where people can be who they are. And then the best kind of friends is someone who's going to call you something.
Yep.
And so you got to do better than this. So, he says it was the longest month of his life when Clara was in the little hive. Or when he thought that Clara was dead, and she's like, it was just a few hours, and he says, I'll be the judge of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll be the judge of time, I think.
Yeah. What do you think he meant, Rob?
I don't know. I've been trying not to think about it too much, because,
Do you think that she's somehow still in there, in a way?
Well, I don't want to start talking about the next episode yet and how this ties in, because, I want to wait to try to do any tie-ins until we talk about the next episode. But I still have, I don't know if I want to call it a hope. I'll call it a hope, because the last few seasons have been a little bit sporadic, and there's still part of me that wants a lot of what's happened to be explained as not the Doctor's reality. As in, there's still a lot of stuff that's happened that I would like to believe that it's just the Doctor asleep and dreaming, maybe, for the lack of a better term. You know, between bringing Gallifrey back, which was pretty much his dream as David Tennant, you know, that was his thing. That was his cross to bear, was my people are gone. I'm alone. Woe is me. And then it came back.
And then it goes away.
Exactly. And it goes away again. Exactly. He locked it away. And, you know, and just other things that happened even as Matt Smith, where... there were just a lot of things that were odd. The Skittles Daleks. Like, the fact that that was... I mean, I know that was just a failed thing that happened, but... I don't know. Even Clara's whole story. I don't want to believe that what we've been given now as her story is the entirety of her story. I would rather believe that this is the Doctor daydreaming, if you will. Hmm. Not because I don't want what's happened to be genuine... But I don't know.
Then how long has this daydream been going on? Since the Pons left, or...?
Maybe. I mean, you know...
The Dream Doctor?
Yeah, maybe.
Since the Dream Doctor? Because, I mean, you know, we've... You know, there are cases of people that, you know, when something terribly traumatic happens, that, you know, they just... They get lost in...
Like he's in a coma?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They get lost in their own world of, like making the world something different than it... You know, not wanting to see reality for what it is.
I gotta say, it's crazy talk.
It is crazy talk. I know that. It's just a TV show, so, I mean, obviously we're overanalyzing it, but I don't know.
It'd be funny if anything about that would come true. I had one other thought. My wife has the idea that the Doctor is a mythological death. And... The anti-war speech for him was he doesn't want to do it anymore. And he's tired of peacekeeping.
Right.
All the people that he would have to harvest, in a way, as he's sort of the angel of death. Not really death, I guess, then. But in a way, sort of mythology of the caricature. And it changes with each culture. But for him, the reason he left in the first place was because he was tired of being death. And it's following him. And no matter what he tries to do, it always comes back to him. And how we saw Clara look in the book and say, oh, that's who. She knows his name somehow without any other reference.
Right.
Without any knowledge of Gallifrey in history or...
Yeah.
She knows his name outside of... Gallifrey's universe. So, or Gallifrey's solar system. So that's the thought. I mean, it could be other things. Could be the Dream Lord, a Morpheus kind of caricature. But there has to be something there about his name. And here we hear Basil is his name. And Dr. Funkenstein and Dr. John Disco and other names. anything. And Doctor is the name that he took to fix, to heal. And so I credit my brilliant wife with her death analysis, because I do think that it fits in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
That his constant companion is death, and no matter what he does to try to save it, and that's why he saved Ashilda too, because he's just so tired of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's also, we tend to think of death in a very black and white term, but a lot of the ancients, death was the flip side of the coin of life. And was usually a lot of often the same being, because you couldn't have life without death, and can't have death without life. And they were, the Hindus had Kali, goddess of death, but also life and rebirth. Isis had elements of that in her as well. A lot of these life goddesses were also personifications of death.
Hell,
yeah. Over and over, and we've partly because of some of the theology that's been brought about of, death is something to be feared and to escape and stuff like that. So we've corrupted its story aspect in a way. Thus, the Doctor becomes us running from death, running from his own life. To kind of piggyback on your wife's idea. Not so much that he's trying to escape being his role, but trying to escape being himself. It's not just a job that he does. And that's why a couple of episodes we talked about how those who are so ecstatic about meeting the Doctor because they know his mythos end up dying, because it's like the moth to the flame. When you get too close, you finally get burned. And so it's not something that he is actively causing or even actively repressing. It just is. And so that's what he's trying to run away from.
Yeah. I always think of the Eccleston episode, too, where everybody lives.
Mm-hmm. They're so happy that everyone finally lived.
Yeah. Well, thanks a lot for listening, guys and girls and people all over the world. And come like us on Facebook if you like the discussion. And anytime, just drop us a line, and we'll give you attention.
Mm-hmm.
We're all about talking Doctor Who and whatever else. So enjoy.